I don't know if you've ever read through or even parts of a book of a Guinness Book of World Record or not, but I got one for Christmas as a teenager, and it fascinated me. I read the thing literally from cover to cover, and I was absolutely astonished by things that people were able to do and gain notoriety. And sometimes they were pretty cool accomplishments, other times they were really silly. Here's an example. This guy's name is Roy Sullivan. He's been struck by lightning seven different times in his life. Between the months of March and June, I'd recommend you not hang out around or near Roy Sullivan. If you're invited to a party with him, don't go. This woman's name is Alyssa Cagnoni. She recorded the loudest burp in history. 107 decibels. That's the equivalent of putting your ear within 3 feet from a jackhammer while it's breaking up concrete. I read that. I was thinking her parents must be really proud of her. This is Michael Lotito. Mr. Lotito ate 2 pounds of metal every day for most of his adult life. This is a true story. Let me just read a list of some of the things he consumed. 18 bicycles, 15 grocery carts, 7 televisions, 2 beds, a pair of skis, a small airplane, and a casket. The last sentence in the article I read about him said, Mr. Lotito died of natural causes in 2007. I read about a family in Lexington, Kentucky that had 21 children. One dad, one mom, 21 kids. One of their sons recently said, my mom had a baby every 9 months and 30 minutes. It's one of the best lines I've ever heard in my life. My humanities teacher in high school was really a very wonderful person, very smart, very talented, very likable. All the students agreed that she was one of the better teachers. But I'll never forget one of the first speeches she gave us in high school. She gave a passionate speech about you can do anything you want to do in life. You can become anything you want to be in life. You can accomplish anything you want to accomplish. And I remember sitting there in class thinking, as much as I liked her as a teacher and as well respected as she was wrong about this. We're all human. We all have limitations. We all have constraints. We all have restraints. There's only so much we can do. There's only so much we can become on our own. And that's why a friendship with Jesus is so very important. Maybe you remember the day when Jesus fed a large crowd of people with some fish and bread, and at the end of the day, he dismissed them. And after they were dismissed, he told his 12 disciples, okay, now I want you guys to go out across the lake, go across the Sea of Galilee, I'll meet you in the morning. And when they left, Jesus went up the side of the mountain to spend some time with his Father in prayer. He had been with crowds for so long, I think he really just needed to catch his breath, honestly. But while he's up there and he's enjoying this time alone just with his Father, a storm sets in. His disciples are in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, and when storms hit that lake, they were usually dangerous storms. He's watching. His disciples are about halfway across the lake, and they're struggling. And Jesus decides he's going to go out and help them. He makes his way down. And here's where things become interesting, because Jesus doesn't have the limitations that you and I have. Like if we were going to go out into the lake to help someone, we'd have to get a boat, rent a kayak or something. But Jesus just stands on the surface and walks across the water. And so he gets out there at the lake, he begins to walk, and he takes one step after another until he's finally within eyesight of the boat, even though he wasn't clear enough for them to see who he was. And when one of the disciples finally sees this figure out in the water, they scream, it's a ghost. Rightfully so. Like, no one's ever seen anyone do something like this before. They've been out on the lake many times. This was completely different for them. It would be scary, but Jesus shouts back, don't be afraid. I mean, imagine you're out on Lake Erie. It's Memorial Day. You're out there with some friends. You've got some friends and their families. They're out on boats. They're enjoying some boating and skiing and tubing, maybe some fishing. And you're out there a couple miles offshore, and someone says, hey, there's a guy over there. And you look, and the guy is not like in a boat. He's standing out in the middle of the Lake Erie. You're in 20 feet water that's 20 feet, 30 feet deep, and there's this guy, he's just out there walking. I mean, everyone grabbed their phones and started taking pictures and videos, right? And then you'd probably start to freak out. Like, even if you're the most calm, cool, collected person in the world, if you're out on Lake Erie and you see someone standing on the water and he's walking towards your boat, it's going to get your attention. You might start the motor up and go off in the other direction. Here's where it gets even a little more interesting. From inside the boat, Peter speaks up after hearing Jesus' voice and says, "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come out on the water." And Jesus gives him a one-word invitation: "Come," Jesus said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. Now, as I was thinking about this story this week, another story got my attention, a book. Someone handed me a book, and I started skimming through it a little bit. It's by a pretty famous historian and economist, and he basically proposes that in American history, every 80 to 100 years, we face a major crisis as a country that causes us to reprioritize things in society. He's basically describing a generational storm. He says they keep coming up every 80 to 100 years. And he begins in with this timeline. He goes back to the 1770s during the time of the American Revolutionary War, and he says, "What good came out of that conflict with Britain was the greatest experiment and expansion of democracy that the world's ever known about." He's right in that assessment. Then he moved up to the 1860s, and he described our Civil War. And he said, "The good that they came out of that internal conflict was our nation was in the Industrial Revolution launched, and it united our country and brought people together." Not a bad outcome. Then he fast-forwarded to the 1930s and 1940s and talked about the Great Depression and World War II. And he said the good that came out of that very bad global war was this economic superpower known as the United States. And we shared our massive wealth and prosperity to a world that desperately needed to heal. We rebuilt much of the rest of the world. And then he wrote, "We're on the brink of another one." He calls it the fourth turning. He said, "At some point during the 2030s, we're going to face another major crisis as a nation." He said, "Right now, just ask anyone if it feels like we're standing on the edge of a waterfall." And I kind of like that visual because I've kind of felt that way to some degree. I mean, I understood what he was saying. He said, one of three things is going to push us over this waterfall. He said, some sort of economic collapse because the debt our nation has taken on is so great we can no longer sustain it. He said, number two, or some internal conflict like a civil war because the political partisanship in our country has gotten way out of control and we're being pulled apart and feel like we've got this wedge just driving people apart. Or, he said, a global war, which he thinks is the most likely because of the axis that's been created between Russia and China and North Korea and Iran, and they want to destroy Western civilization as we know it. So you came here for some good news today, right? I mean, I'm literally reading this gloom and doom, this predictive scenario, and I thought to myself, if or when we get pushed over this waterfall, and I hope we don't, but if or when we do, I want to be in the boat with the guy who can walk on water. And I think that's the key. So let me draw out some simple applications from Matthew 14 that I hope will bring you some peace no matter how bad things get in your life or your home or your country, whatever it is. The first is this: when Peter cried out, Jesus reached out. Now again, I don't want our country to go through an economic collapse or a civil war or a global war. I'm not suggesting that's even going to happen. That was just some guy's idea. I kind of think we had the fourth turning when we had the economic depression 10 years ago and 9/11 and things like that. But if any of this new stuff does happen, we've chosen to walk with the God who can walk on water. That being said, everywhere I go, and I mean everywhere, what I'm hearing in conversation is what psychologists refer to as catastrophic thinking. Catastrophic thinking happens when we begin to believe that the most unlikely scenarios are somehow going to become very likely in our lives. I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a friend, and your friend goes through some ugly divorce because their spouse cheated on them. And you, because you're in close proximity to that relationship and you know all about it, you begin to get concerned about your own spouse. And now you're suspicious. They've never given you a reason to not trust them, but now you're suspicious. That's catastrophic thinking. You think the worst despite any evidence against that. Or you're a parent, and you hear about some car accident that teenagers are in. Some kids are partying, and now you become a private investigator. You're snooping around the social media accounts of all of your kids' friends. You've got every possible location app you can get, and you begin to look suspiciously at your children. And it's good to be protective, right? I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting against that. But you're crazy suspicious, even though they've never given you a reason to be. You're concerned. It's catastrophic thinking. Maybe it's your work environment. Maybe you supervise at work, and it comes back to you that they're kind of talking about your behind your back a little bit. And now you begin thinking that everyone's talking behind your back about you. And you get to the point where you start manipulating and maybe even punishing the entire organization. It's all catastrophic thinking. I have no doubt that in that boat on the Sea of Galilee on that particular day we're looking at today, that there was some catastrophic thinking. Some of these discussions were going on. I mean, they were on the brink of drowning. You would probably be terrified at that moment, and one of their own, a fisherman who knows better than anyone else not to step out into the water, especially during a storm, is getting ready to walk out of the boat. And you can hear the other people in the boat saying, "Peter, what in the world are you doing? Are you nuts? Get back in the boat." But Peter was operating by a completely different paradigm that most of them have not yet come to understand. And it's summed up in a single verse in the Bible where it says, "It is impossible to please God without faith." Let me say that again. It is impossible to please God without faith. Let me apply that collectively to us as a church. Anytime God nudges Tri-County to do something risky, it has the potential of being catastrophic. But here's a truth that we've experienced historically as a congregation and that I've seen played out in congregations time and time and time again. Big risks are always blessed by God with big reward. Always. Every single time. So here's the framework. We have to get comfortable with the idea there are only two options when it comes to our personal relationships with Jesus Christ. We can either be boat potatoes or wave walkers. That's it. That's the only two options. I don't see Peter as a failure because he sank. The other guys, the other 11 failed because they didn't even try. So when it comes to us, no matter what it is, Peter's the only one of that group of 12 who could say, "I walked on the water." I mean, that's crazy. That's something. And you should want that too. So don't be a play it safer. Be a risk taker. Whatever it is in your life, trust God in the midst because he honors that risk with great reward. I like the way John Ortberg describes this whole mentality. He said, "See a middle-aged man who spends his night sitting in front of a television viewing whatever sports happens to be on. He was once fired up with bright plans for the future and strong yearning to make his mark on the world, but somewhere along the line, all the fire went out and he settled for comfort. His dreams were sacrificed to a lazy boy and flickering images on a screen. He is the story of unrealized potential, abilities and gifts that never got cultivated and deployed until weeks become months and months turn into years, and one day you're looking back on a life of deep, intimate, gut-wrenchingly honest conversations you never had. Great, bold prayers you never prayed. Exhilarating risk you never took. Sacrificial gifts you never offered, lives you never touched, and you're sitting in a recliner with a shriveled soul and forgotten dreams, and you realize there was a world of desperate need, and a great God calling you to be part of something bigger than yourself, you see the person you could have become, but you did not because you never followed your calling. You never got out of the boat. I have a friend, I went to Bible college with him. His wife left him for another man. He got a divorce he never wanted, but he had no choice. He left his ministry because they thought that divorce was going to disqualify him from ever serving in the church again. When his dad heard about that, he got in his car immediately and drove all night long so he could look at his son face to face and tell him that failure is not failure. A failure is not fatal. Failure is forgivable. And that's always true when you're a follower of Jesus Christ. Always. I'm so glad that after he took a season to rest and heal, that he got back into ministry, because he's one of the finest preachers I know. And who better now to help other people who are struggling with a broken home than someone who's been through it, someone who understands it, someone who's been in and out of it. So whatever it is in your past that Satan loves to bring into your present, remind him it's already been forgiven by Jesus. Your failures, they're not failure. Jesus can not only leverage it for your own good, but for the good of others if you're willing to share that with others. So be a good steward of your scars. Be a good steward of even your scars, because when Jesus invites you to take a risk, if there's one thing that's going to keep you from going and getting out of the boat, it could be a past failure. I tried before. It didn't work out. I'm not trying again. Don't let that stop you. It shouldn't stop you. Here's the second point I want to make. Peace is not about the absence of storms. Peace is about the presence of Jesus in the storm. Years ago, I was teaching a class, had a group of people, and I asked the group, hey, what's something that you dread? Goes right back to our communion meditation almost. What is something that you don't want to hear? What's a fear? What's something that you don't want someone to say to you? What's some of the worst news you could get? Someone said, I don't want to hear a spouse say, I don't love you anymore. I don't want to answer a phone in the middle of the night and hear a state trooper say there's been an accident. I don't want to be in the youth pastor's office and hear your daughter's pregnant or your son's addicted. I don't want my spouse to come home and say I lost my job today. I don't want a nurse practitioner look at an ultrasound and say we can't find a heartbeat. I don't want to have the coroner call and say it wasn't accidental. They took their own life. I don't want to hear a judge or attorney say, I'm sorry, but you're going to jail. Those are storms that some of you have weathered. Some may be weathering, and others might be going to weather. And if you've ever seen the destruction caused by a tornado or hurricane or tsunami, that's the way it feels emotionally when someone drops horrific news on your lap. You can just look on the debris of the landscape and wonder, can anything good come out of this? And exactly in that moment of hopelessness and despair, that is when Jesus shows up and does his very best work. Typically, he wants to lead you away from the brokenness and put you in the direction of restoration. So I asked that same class of people when we got near the end of the lesson. I said, hey, let's flip the script a little bit. What's on the other side? Some of you have been there. You've heard the bad news. What can you hear that brings you peace? What is it that brings you comfort? What's that look like? The very first thing someone shouted out was blue skies. Isn't that interesting? A beeline straight to creation. God could have made skies brown, gray. He made them blue and vibrant. Another person said, falling snow, and they immediately connected it to the promise of Isaiah when he said, though my sins were like scarlet, he made me white as snow, purified me, cleansed me. He did the same for you. Someone else said, sitting by a campfire. I can resonate with this one. The smell of it, the sound of it, it's just relaxing. Sunrises and sunsets. Psalm 113 says, from the rising of the sun to the place where it sets, the name of the Lord is to be praised. It means anywhere you go, God's worthy of your praise. How about a gentle rain after a long winter? And up from the ground comes some new, fresh greenery, new life, resurrection. It's not death all alone. It's a good reminder that there's always life on the other side. A good meal with friends, one of my favorites. I love getting together with people I enjoy being with and just having a meal together, sharing our lives with one another. What about this one? Sitting on a beach chair, watching the waves come in. It does something good for your blood pressure. It reminds you that there's a great, big, huge world out there, and there's a God in control of it all. How about a sleeping baby? It's nearly a picture of perfection. It's a picture of innocence in a world that's gone corrupt. Peace is not just the absence of a storm. It's the presence of Jesus in the storm. When Josiah was just 4 or 5 years old, he got a bad cut on his knee. There was an infection. It was pretty scary for a while. But he got some treatment and was recovering. But part of the follow-up care was he had to go for a blood test, and he did not want to go for that blood test. And the nurse came to him, and she started to inject the needle, and he just would not hold still. He wasn't going to allow this to happen if he had a choice. And the nurse told me that I was going to have to hold him. And he was terrified. He wanted nothing to do with it. And now I'm the one who had to force him to sit still and to hold him into place and hold his arm in place. And I remember telling him, this won't hurt as much as you think it will. It's going to go by quick. No matter what the pain, it won't last. And I'm not going to leave you. I knew a little poke was coming, a little pain. But I also knew I was going to hold him and I'm going to help him get through it. And we've been there a lot as parents. And that's why I resonate with the words of God in the Bible where he looks at us as his children and he says, I will never let you down. I will never walk off and leave you. And he's been true to his word. You've never spent a moment of your life unnoticed. You've never spent a day of your life unloved. He is always watching. He even is with you when you make mistakes. And guess what he doesn't do when you make mistakes? He doesn't throw his hands up in the air and walk away and just leave you behind. He doesn't walk off in frustration. It's just the opposite. He's a good dad. Remember when you taught your kids to walk? You know, what'd you do? You held out your fingers and they grabbed hold of them and they were eventually used you to balance. And then pretty soon you realized, I think they can do this without my fingers. And you put them on the ground, you took your fingers away, and you sent them on their way, and you knew what was going to happen, right? They were going to fall down. You knew before they fell that they were going to, but what'd you do? You scooped them up, you steadied them, you encouraged them, and you sent them off again. And you kept doing that because you knew eventually after walking was going to come running and then jumping. And there were all these things to look forward to, and that's the way faith works. Your first steps. He's always with you, guarding and guiding and protecting. He's also there cheering you on. There's not a moment in your life when God has thrown in the towel or gives up on you. A few days ago, I was reading about an accident that happened because of some fog. The fog was so dense, people couldn't see more than 10 feet in front of them. And the article went on to describe how fog occurs. And I kind of knew a little bit about that. I'm not very good at science, but I knew a little bit about fog. But I didn't know the details like I learned in this article. The article went on to say that a city skyline, an entire city skyline with all of its tall buildings, could be taken out of view by fog that takes only about a glass of water to create. And I'm like, that can't be true. But I kept reading. And the data was explained. And sure enough, if you wanted to take a 7-square block of a downtown and just envelop it in dense fog, it would need about a cup of water. And I remember thinking to myself, how could something seemingly so small and insignificant create something so distracting, like that fog that caused an accident? I hope you're wondering that too, because I got another example. And I know I've talked about this recently. I'm not going to keep harping on it forever, but it's a common discussion in my home and a battle sometimes. But if you want to see something that's really small and distracting that can get us off course real quick, here it is. Right? As I'm preaching, my son's got one in his hand looking at it. You have probably heard the statistics, but here are some reminders. 57% of teenage girls experience persistent feelings of hopelessness. That number doubled within a year of putting front-facing cameras on our phones. The lead researcher said 12-year-old girls spend hours each day taking selfies, editing selfies, posting them for friends, enemies, and strangers to comment on, while also spending hours each day scrolling through the photos of other girls and fabulously wealthy female celebrities with seemingly vastly superior bodies and lives. The hours spent each day on Instagram were taken from sleep, exercise, time with family and friends. He ends by saying, what did we think would happen to them? 8 to 12-year-olds are spending an average of 5 hours a day on their phone. Teenagers are spending 8 hours a day on their phone. It's not just negatively impacting them and their view of relationships, potentially for the rest of their lives, it's also negatively impacting those who call adults. He went on to describe some of the issues with teens and said it's taken away from their imaginations. It's causing the lowering of their standardized test scores in school. It's creating real problems for employers with their new employees who don't know how to work without having a phone in hand. He says it's distorting their view of relationships and distorting their view of reality. Then he said, 77% of Americans between ages of 35 and 54 also want to return to a time before society was always plugged in, a time before we had pocket phones in our pockets that ruled our lives. Now, I like everyone here, but I could build a very strong case that there's so much reason for this catastrophic thinking that we talked about earlier that's going on in our society. The scrolling robs us of peace that Jesus plants in the heart, that the Holy Spirit develops and cultivates. These phones replace all of that with fear and anxiety and worry. There was a massive study done on Americans. They had people write down all of the things they worry about in the course of a day, and they said, we want you to do this for months. And after they did this, they took all of the people in the study, and they were all interviewed on an individual basis. So everyone had these journals filled day after day after day after day after day with things they worried. And then they went through them and discovered how many of those worries after 9 months came true. They discovered 91% of what we worry about never happens. 91% of the average person's worry. That number is going to go up for some people. Never happened. Mark Twain said, I've been through some really terrible things in my life, some of which actually happened. One of the worst things that could happen to you and me is that we live a life of mounting regret. 11 guys never got out of the boat. Don't let that happen to you. Whatever your boat is, whatever that safe place is, wherever you go to hide, can I just challenge you to get out of that place? Get out of the boat. Like, go on a missionary trip. Stretch yourself spiritually. Get involved in a ministry that helps people somehow. Serve somebody. See what happens to your heart and mind. If you're not in a Bible study, start attending one. Start a new one. It will blow you away what real friendship on an intimate, personal basis with others will do to you. Connectivity with another human being studying scriptures is powerful, and we've gotten away with it, and we've gotten away from it. We were not created to have relationships through a device. We were created to have personal connections with people. So all I want you to do is set these down a little bit more this year so that you can read and pray and think, experience, taste, feel, heal. Minimize regret. And I promise you this, you will maximize peace in your life. It seems counterintuitive, but ask Peter. He'll tell you it's true. I'll leave you with this. This little guy's name is Dylan Sketch. 4 years old, on the 4th of July, he told his family, I'm diving off this diving board this year. And they were surprised by it because they've been trying to get him to dive off the diving board for about a year since he was 3 years old. They did this over and over, but this day, just like the others, they put his floaties on him. They stayed very close by. They were coaching him, encouraging him. They even eventually tried to bribe him because even after he said he was going to do it, then he started to get away from it and said, no, I'm not going to. He eventually stepped off of that diving board back on the deck in fear. He was afraid of what was going to happen. Sitting nearby underneath a shady tree in his lawn chair was 95-year-old Daniel Bliss, a veteran of World War II. He heard all of this, so he got up with his cane, borrowed a pair of swimming trunks, and made his way to the end of that diving board. He wasn't stable by any stretch of the imagination. He was wobbly as they get. His balance, his equilibrium was off, but he took a dive. You saw it. It wasn't pretty. At 95 years of age, I don't know what you'd expect, you know. But I'll tell you this. That last man's dive led to a little boy's first dive. And he understood an important axiom in life, and that is kids don't need us to say, this is how you do it. They need us to show them, this is how you do it. I'm telling you, the next generation is watching. There's a ton at stake for our church, for our country, a lot. And they don't need for us to tell them nearly as much as they need us to show them, this is how you live by faith. If we want our lives to look differently and to end up differently than most other people's lives do, we need to live differently. Get out of the boat. Don't be a boat potato, be a wave walker. Don't be a play it safer, be a risk taker. Live with more faith. Big risk, because on the other side of that big risk is a big reward.